A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one from a coffee shop in Cork. He's in the middle of a move, exhausted, and for the first time he actually gets why his mother loves people. Watching. He's sitting there, watching customers come and go, picking up fragments of conversation, and he realizes there's something oddly peaceful about it. Which is a big deal for him, because he's the kind of person who'd normally never sit alone in a cafe. Too self-conscious, worried about looking like a weird loner. But the exhaustion of the move just kind of dissolved that filter.
He's onto something real here. That moment where you stop being a participant and become an observer, it's not just zoning out, it's a different mode entirely.
And he connects it to something he saw growing up on family holidays in Portugal. Groups of men sitting on benches, chatting, literally just watching traffic go by. He says it's a form of social bonding that feels lost on Israeli culture, and he wonders if anyone's ever coined a term for it. But the bigger question he's asking is, why do we feel this need to step back from the bustle and just watch? He thinks there's something almost metaphysical about it, like you have to pull back from the endless train of errands to see that your daily routine is just one of millions of variants playing out across the city.
That's a beautifully framed question, and it lands at a moment when deliberately doing nothing, just watching, feels almost subversive. We're in this era of constant productivity pressure, algorithmic feeds that never stop, and the idea that every minute should be optimized. Sitting on a bench watching the world go by? That's practically an act of rebellion.
It shouldn't be, but it is. And what Daniel's describing, that shift from self-consciousness to peace? That's the gateway. The moment you stop worrying about how you look and start actually seeing what's in front of you.
Let's trace this thing properly. We'll start in 19th century Paris with a figure called the flâneur, the original people watcher as cultural archetype. Then we'll get into what's actually happening in the brain when you shift into observation mode. The default mode network, diffuse attention, the spotlight effect, and its liberating opposite. And from there, we'll ask what it means for how we live now. In a world that's designed to keep us from ever just watching.
Whether those Portuguese bench sitters have been onto something for generations that the rest of us are only starting to rediscover.
Here's where we have to start. What Daniel felt in that Cork coffee shop wasn't just the relief of sitting down after hauling boxes. Something specific was happening in his brain. And the best way to understand it is to look at this figure from 19th century Paris, the flâneur.
Which sounds like someone who's about to serve you an overpriced pastry, but is actually one of the more useful concepts for understanding modern life.
Charles Baudelaire popularized the term in his essay, The Painter of Modern Life, published in 1863. The flâneur was this figure who strolled through the arcades and boulevards of Paris, watching the crowd, observing the theater of urban life as it was emerging. Baudelaire described him as a passionate spectator, someone who is at the center of the world and yet hidden from it, present but apart.
Basically, the guy at the cafe window seat in 1863.
And what makes the flâneur interesting is that he wasn't just killing time. He was doing something Baudelaire considered almost artistic, reading the city like a text, noticing the small dramas, the fashion, the gestures, the fleeting moments that everyone else was too busy to see. The New Yorker ran a piece on this, tracing the flâneur from Baudelaire through the German philosopher Walter Benjamin, who made the flâneur a central figure in his unfinished Arcades project, this massive study of 19th century Parisian life.
Benjamin spent years on that project and never finished it, which is either ironic or perfectly on brand for a philosopher of the stroll.
Here's the key insight, Benjamin added. The flâneur is a product of modernity itself. The industrial city creates anonymity. You can walk through a crowd and be unseen. That's terrifying to some people, but to the flâneur, it's liberating. You're in the crowd, but not of it. You're observing without the pressure of being observed back.
That's exactly the shift Daniel described. He normally can't sit alone in a cafe because he's acutely aware of how he might look to others. But the exhaustion lowered that barrier, and suddenly he was on the other side of the glass, watching, instead of feeling watched.
Which brings us to the psychology. There's a phenomenon called the spotlight effect, coined by Thomas Jilovich and his colleagues in a study published in the year 2000 in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. The finding is simple but powerful. We consistently overestimate how much other people notice us. We think we're under a spotlight, but we're really not. Jilovich had students wear embarrassing t-shirts and then asked them to estimate how many people in a room noticed. The students guessed about 50%. The actual number was closer to 25%.
Daniel's fear that everyone in the coffee shop is thinking, "Who's that weird loner talking into his phone?" Statistically, most of them haven't even registered he exists.
And here's where it gets interesting. The spotlight effect makes being alone in public feel uncomfortable because you assume you're being judged, but people watching flips the dynamic. When you shift from participant to observer, you're no longer the one under the imagined spotlight, you're the one holding it, and that can be genuinely liberating.
It's like you reclaim the gaze. Instead of being the subject of everyone else's attention, which you never actually were, you become the one doing the noticing.
The brain rewards this. Let's talk about what's happening neurologically when you're just watching the world go by. There are two broad modes of attention. Focused attention is what you use when you're doing a task, writing an email, following a recipe, navigating a busy street. It's goal-directed, narrow, and it burns energy. Then there's diffuse attention, broader, more receptive, less directed at any one thing. This is the mode associated with what neuroscientists call the default mode network, or DMN.
The default mode network, which sounds like the factory setting on a router, but is actually one of the most important discoveries in neuroscience in the last few decades.
Marcus Reichle first identified it in 2001. The DMN is a set of brain regions that become active when you're not focused on an external task, when you're daydreaming, mind-wandering, or just letting your thoughts drift. For a long time, scientists thought the brain at rest was just idle, but the DMN showed that your brain is actually doing important integrative work during these periods, connecting ideas, processing emotions, consolidating memories.
When Daniel's sitting in that coffee shop, not focused on anything in particular, just watching people come and go, his DMN is lighting up. His brain is doing background maintenance.
Here's the crucial detail, people. Watching provides just enough gentle external stimulus to keep you from falling into rumination. If you sit in a silent room staring at a blank wall, your mind might spiral into anxious loops, replaying arguments, worrying about the future. But if you're watching the world, your attention is lightly engaged. You notice the barista's rhythm, the couple having a tense conversation, the guy who can't decide between two pastries. These small observations anchor you in the present without demanding focused effort.
It's like the brain's sweet spot. Enough input to prevent the spiral, not enough to create cognitive load.
That's why it feels meditative. The DMN is active during self-referential thought, thinking about yourself, your past, your future. People watching gives the DMN material to work with that isn't you. You're integrating your own experience, but you're doing it through the lens of watching others. It's empathy training, pattern recognition, and emotional processing all at once.
Which explains why Daniel felt that peace even though his mind was busy. He wasn't zoning out. He was in a different kind of active state. One that doesn't feel productive in the conventional sense, but is doing real work.
This connects directly to the Portuguese bench sitters Daniel mentioned. Because what those men are doing isn't just individual meditation. It's a social ritual. They're watching together. They're creating a shared reference point without the pressure of constant conversation. Someone points out a funny license plate, someone else comments on a pedestrian's hat, and then they lapse back into comfortable silence. The observation is the activity.
There's a Portuguese term that might fit here, saudade. That melancholic longing, but with an appreciation of the present moment folded into it. Watching the world go by with your friends, not trying to change it or participate in it, just witnessing it together.
That's what Daniel noticed is missing from Israeli culture. In Israel, sitting on a bench doing nothing is unusual. The culture is so oriented toward action, toward purpose, toward engagement. The idea of just watching traffic, it doesn't compute.
Which is ironic, because Israel is also a culture where people are constantly in each other's business. But there's a difference between being nosy and being a flaneur. Nosiness wants information. The flaneur wants experience.
The brain loves this. The DMN gets to do its integrative work. The spotlight effect gets neutralized. You get the benefits of meditation without the discipline of sitting still with your eyes closed. But there's a deeper question here, and I think it's what Daniel was really driving at when he called it metaphysical.
Because it's not just about feeling good for 20 minutes. It's about what happens when you step back far enough to see your own life as one thread in a larger pattern.
That's where we need to go next. The psychology explains the mechanism, but the meaning of it. Why it feels important, not just pleasant. That's a bigger conversation.
Let's unpack what was actually happening in that coffee shop, and why it felt so different from just sitting around doing nothing. Because Daniel's description is very specific. He's not scrolling, he's not reading. He's not even really resting in the conventional sense. He's watching.
That distinction matters. People watching isn't passive in the way that zoning out in front of a television is passive. It's a deliberate orientation toward the world. You're stepping out of participation and into observation. The difference between being in the parade and watching it from the curb.
Which is why it feels so different from boredom. Boredom is restless. You're looking for something to engage you and not finding it. People watching is the opposite. You're already engaged. The world is providing an endless stream of material and you're just receiving it.
That's the puzzle Daniel stumbled into. He went into that coffee shop because he was exhausted, physically and mentally drained from the move. He didn't plan to have a revelation about the nature of attention. He just needed to sit down. But the exhaustion did something interesting. It lowered his self-consciousness enough that he could actually notice what was happening around him.
He says it himself. Normally, he'd never sit alone in a cafe because he'd be worrying about looking like a weird loner. But the fatigue just dissolved that filter. He didn't have the energy to care about the imaginary judgment of strangers.
Which is a perfect illustration of the spotlight effect at work. His normal state is hyper-aware of how he might appear. The exhaustion didn't make other people less judgmental. They were never judging him in the first place. It just made him stop caring about a spotlight that was never actually on him.
Once that filter dropped, something else rushed in. The piece he describes, the enjoyment of watching people come and go, picking up fragments of conversation. It's almost like the self-consciousness was taking up so much bandwidth that there was no room left for actual observation.
Self-consciousness is a form of attention that's directed entirely inward. You're monitoring yourself, adjusting your posture, wondering how you look. It's exhausting, and it leaves no cognitive space for noticing the world outside your own head.
When Daniel says maybe it's the exhaustion, he's right, but not because exhaustion is inherently peaceful. It's because exhaustion temporarily disabled the self-monitoring system that normally keeps him from this kind of experience.
What he found on the other side of that was, I think, what his mother and Cork has known all along. People watching isn't a consolation prize for having nothing better to do. It's a genuine mode of being in the world. His mother described herself as an ardent fan. That's not casual language. That's someone who's discovered something worth being enthusiastic about.
Which brings us to the Portuguese bench sitters. Because what Daniel's describing there is a cultural version of the same thing. These aren't isolated individuals staring at traffic. They're groups of men, sitting together, chatting intermittently, and watching the world go by. It's social, but the social glue isn't conversation. It's shared observation.
That's a really specific form of bonding. When you're watching the same street, the same pedestrians, the same cars, you're building a shared reference point without having to articulate it. Someone nods toward a funny license plate. Someone else comments on a dog that's walking its owner more than the other way around. And then you lapse back into silence. The silence isn't awkward because the observation is the activity.
It's almost like the opposite of a dinner party, where the pressure is entirely on conversation to carry the evening. On the bench, the world is doing the entertaining. You're just there to witness it together.
Daniel noticed this is missing from Israeli culture. I've lived here long enough to see what he means. In Israel, if you're sitting on a bench not doing anything, someone will ask if you're okay. The culture doesn't really have a category for deliberate idleness. Everything is supposed to have a purpose.
Whereas in Portugal, apparently, watching traffic is a perfectly legitimate way to spend an afternoon. Nobody's asking the bench sitters what their 5-year plan is.
Which raises the question Daniel is really asking. Is this just a cultural quirk? One country's way of killing time versus another's? Or is there something deeper going on? He used the word metaphysical. He talked about stepping back from the endless train of errands to see the bigger picture. That's not a description of boredom. That's a description of perspective taking.
I think that's the core tension here. We tend to categorize activities as either productive or unproductive. If you're not working toward a goal, you're wasting time. but people watching doesn't fit neatly into either category. It's not productive in the conventional sense. You're not generating output. But it doesn't feel like wasting time either. It feels important.
Almost like the brain knows something we don't. Like there's a kind of processing that only happens when you stop trying to process things.
The question becomes, is this just a pleasant way to pass 20 minutes, or is there something necessary about stepping back and watching the bigger picture? And if it is necessary, why have we designed a world that makes it so hard to do?
This is where the view from above idea comes in. The Stoics had a practice. Marcus Aurelius writes about it in the Meditations, where you imagine yourself from a great height, seeing your life as one tiny point in a vast network of human activity. It sounds morbid, but the effect is actually the opposite. It's calming. Your problems shrink to their actual size.
That's exactly what Daniel described. Your daily routine, as stressful and overwhelming as it often seems, is just part of one of millions of variants in the city. Everybody is going about their own version of it. That's not nihilism. That's perspective. He's not saying his problems don't matter. He's saying they're not the whole story.
Which is a spiritual insight, whether you frame it in religious terms or not. Zen Buddhism has this concept of beginner's mind, approaching experience without preconception, just seeing what's there. And walking meditation, where each step is the whole practice. People watching sit somewhere between those two. You're moving slowly or not at all, and you're receiving the world without trying to edit it.
The slow-looking movement in our museums taps into the same thing. Research shows the average museum visitor spends about 15 to 30 seconds in front of a painting. Slow-looking programs push that to 10 minutes or more. And people report seeing things they'd never noticed. Details, relationships, emotional resonances. The painting doesn't change. Their attention does.
The skill transfers. Learning to really look at a painting trained you to really look at a street corner. Same muscle, different canvas.
Here's the thing. We've built a world that actively works against this. Daniel was self-conscious about talking into his phone in the coffee shop. But ironically, the phone was also his alibi. If you're staring at a screen, nobody questions why you're alone. You look busy. You look legitimate. If you're just sitting there watching people, suddenly you're suspicious.
The phone as social cover. It signals, I have a reason to be here that you understand. Whereas pure observation, just looking at the world, that doesn't register as a valid activity. And that's a recent development. 50 years ago, sitting alone in public without a prop was perfectly normal. The smartphone didn't create the discomfort with idleness, but it gave us a way to hide from it that made the discomfort worse.
Because now the absence of a phone feels intentional. You're not just sitting there. You're choosing not to scroll. And that choice reads as weird.
Which brings us to the productivity paradox. We feel guilty when we're not doing something. But observation is doing something. It's data collection, pattern recognition, social learning. It's how children learn to be human. They watch adults constantly. We just forget that adults need it too.
The most innovative companies have figured this out. Pixar's headquarters in Emeryville, Steve Jobs designed the central atrium specifically to force what they called unplanned collaborations. The bathrooms, the cafes, the mailboxes, everything funnels through this one big open space. You can't avoid running into people from other teams. You can't avoid observing what's happening around you.
Jobs called it the collision. Design. He wanted people to bump into each other, literally and figuratively. And the atrium isn't just for talking, it's for watching. You see animators, writers, executives all moving through the same space. You absorb the rhythm of the place. That's passive observation feeding creative work.
The companies that depend on creativity the most have built observation into their architecture. Meanwhile, the rest of us are apologizing for sitting on a bench.
The cultural variation here is striking. Daniel pointed out that Portuguese bench sitting feels lost on Israeli culture. I've lived in both worlds, stores, Connecticut, and Jerusalem, and the American version is almost as uncomfortable with public idleness as the Israeli one, just for different reasons. In America, if you're sitting on a bench not doing anything, people assume you're either homeless or up to something. In Israel, they assume you need help. Neither culture has a comfortable category for, I'm just watching.
Whereas in Portugal, apparently, it's a legitimate afternoon activity. Nobody's calling the authorities.
That says something about what different cultures value. Cultures that prioritize productivity and action. Israel, the U.S. They don't know what to do with contemplation that doesn't produce an output. Cultures with a stronger tradition of just being. And Portugal has that in its bones, the saudade, the acceptance of melancholy as part of life. They've made space for the bench.
The question becomes, what are we losing when we lose the bench? Not just the physical bench, though that matters, but the permission to use it. The cultural category for, I am here, I am watching, and that is enough.
I think we lose access to a specific kind of knowing. The kind that doesn't come from reading or analyzing or producing, it comes from letting the world impress itself on you without forcing it into a framework. Daniel said it felt meditative. I'd go further. It felt true. Not true in the factual sense, but true in the sense of being aligned with something real.
That's the metaphysical peace he was reaching for. When you step back from the endless train of errands, you're not escaping your life. You're seeing it from the outside for a moment, and from that angle, it looks different, but also more connected to everything else.
Which is exactly what the DMN is doing at the neural level, integrating your experience into a larger pattern. The brain and the soul, if you want to use that word, are doing the same work, making meaning out of fragments.
The Portuguese bench sitters, the Parisian flaneur, Daniel's mother in Cork, Daniel himself in that coffee shop, they're all practicing the same thing, a kind of attention that doesn't demand answers. How do you actually do this? Because knowing it's good for you and doing it are different things. Most people hear people watching is great for your brain, and then immediately pick up their phone to tweet about it.
The first thing is embarrassingly simple. 15 minutes in a cafe or on a bench with no phone, no book, no agenda. Treat it like a practice, not an accident. The reason most people don't do this isn't that they're too busy. It's that they've never given themselves permission.
The phone is the hardest part. It's not just a distraction. It's an alibi. Without it, you feel exposed. With it, you're just someone checking messages. The practice is sitting with that discomfort for a few minutes until it fades.
Which it does. The research on habit formation shows that the first 2 or 3 minutes of any new behavior feel unnatural. Then your brain adjusts. The same thing happens here. The first few minutes of just watching feel awkward, almost performative. Then something shifts and you're actually seeing.
The second thing is, you don't need a cafe. The flaneur wasn't sitting down. He was walking. Your daily commute, if you have one, is already observation time that you're probably filling with scrolling. Instead of pulling out your phone on the bus or the train, just watch. Notice the patterns. Who gets on at which stop? The small dramas playing out in the seats around you.
This is a form of mindfulness that doesn't require sitting still with your eyes closed, which a lot of people find intolerable. You're moving through the world, but your attention is receptive instead of directed. It's the same diffuse mode we talked about with the default mode network, just in motion.
The commute is perfect for this because it's already dead time. You're not stealing minutes from productivity. You're upgrading minutes that were already lost to scrolling.
The third one is the one I think could actually catch on. Normalize shared observation with friends. Instead of meeting for coffee where the expectation is constant conversation, suggest a bench. Bring a coffee if you want, but the activity is watching, not talking. The Portuguese have been onto this for generations. Daniel saw it firsthand.
It solves the self-consciousness problem entirely. Sitting alone on a bench can feel weird. Two people on a bench watching the world? That's just friends hanging out. Nobody questions it.
The social dimension also changes what you notice. When you're watching with someone else, you start pointing things out to each other. A gesture, an outfit, a moment. You're building that shared reference point Daniel described. And the silences aren't awkward because the observation is the activity.
I think the deeper reframe here is this, people. Watching isn't laziness, and it isn't loneliness. It's a form of attention training. Every minute you spend watching without judging, without an agenda, without trying to extract something useful, you're building a capacity that transfers to everything else. Empathy, because you're noticing other people's lives. Creativity, because you're letting your brain make unexpected connections. Perspective, because you're seeing your own life as one thread in a larger fabric.
The next time you feel self-conscious sitting alone somewhere, remember the math. The spotlight effect means most people haven't even registered you're there. And if they have, they're not thinking weird loner. They're probably thinking about their own problems, or wondering if they left the stove on, or trying to remember the name of that actor from that show.
You're not being weird. You're being a flaneur. Baudelaire would approve.
Daniel's mother and Cork would approve. Which might be the higher compliment?
Here's what I'm left wondering, and I'll leave you with this. What happens when we actually design our cities and our lives to make observation easier? Benches, piazzas, cafe seating that faces outward instead of into a screen. These aren't luxuries, they're infrastructure for human flourishing, and we treat them like optional decorations.
It's a design question that most cities don't even know they're failing. You walk through a modern downtown, and there's nowhere to just sit unless you're buying something. The message is, if you're not transacting, move along. But the bench is a public good. It says you're allowed to be here without a reason.
As AI and automation take over more of the tasks that currently fill our days, and that's coming faster than most people want to admit, we're going to have more time. The question is whether we'll embrace that time or fill it with more screens, more ways to avoid just being present.
The default will be more screens, because that's where the money is. Every minute you spend watching the world is a minute you're not watching an ad. The entire attention economy is built on making observation without a device feel like a waste. And we've internalized that so deeply that we reach for the phone before we even notice we're doing it.
Daniel's mother in Cork has been onto something all along. She called herself an ardent fan of people watching. Not a casual enjoyer, an ardent fan. That's someone who discovered that this isn't a hobby, it's a way of being in the world. And maybe, just maybe, it's what we need more of. Not more productivity acts, not more optimized mornings. Just sitting somewhere and letting the world happen in front of you.
The flaneur would recognize her immediately. Baudelaire said the flaneur is someone who sees the world with the eye of an artist, but the detachment of a philosopher. That's not a description of killing time. That's a description of a practice. And it's one that's available to anyone with 15 minutes and a place to sit.
Here's to the bench sitters, the cafe window people, the Portuguese men watching traffic, Daniel's mother in Cork, and Daniel himself, exhausted in a coffee shop, finally too tired to care what anyone thought, and accidentally stumbling into something that's been true all along.
If you have a weird prompt about the hidden structure of everyday life, the things we do without knowing why, the patterns we've stopped noticing, send it in. We'll explore it. That's what this show is for.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for making this possible. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1880s, a French agronomist visiting the Niger River Valley in what is now Mali reported discovering an ancient strain of pearl millet cultivated by local farmers that could supposedly survive 2 full years without rainfall. The claim was widely cited in European agricultural journals for decades until a Belgian botanist revisited the region in 1904 and realized the agronomist had misunderstood the farmers entirely. They were rotating fields and the millet was perfectly ordinary. The miracle grain was just good crop management.
Oh, right.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, tell someone about it. Or better yet, go sit on a bench with them and watch the world go by. We'll be back soon with more.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.